The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
People have heard Supreme Court ruled on Thursday. They've upheld the Obama's affordable, it's got a long name. I call it the APA, the Affordable Protection Act. So Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. This is, to understand the context, this is the signature political, domestic political accomplishment of the Obama presidency. This is, and not only is it seen that way by Obama or, it's understood that way by the Democratic Party, Obama even takes it further, and he claims that the ACA is, quote, the most important piece of social legislation since the Social Security Act passed in the 1930s, and the most important reform of our healthcare system since Medicaid passed in the 1960s.
Wow.
So if that's true, then the Supreme Court decision should cause quite a bit of celebration, amongst progressive forces. And sure enough, there's plenty of people who are, really jumping for joy. There's a rally outside of the Capitol, and people see pictures in the Times, New York Times, sorry, I said the Times. Every union put out a statement saying, what a victory this was, some stronger than others. And the question is, what is it that we're actually celebrating? What are the things that these different forces are celebrating? And I think there's sort of three questions asked. Are people celebrating the fact that this ruling will help get Obama reelected, in November? I think that's one reason some people are celebrating. Are folks celebrating, the fact that a lunatic right wing in this country, didn't score another victory? I think that is another thing people are celebrating. And then the third thing I think people might be celebrating are folks celebrating the continued existence of a legislation that people actually think will make healthcare better in this country. So I think depending on, how that plays out and why people, are looking to this thing and what might kind of can determine then how we think about those things and respond. On the first point, socialists and other people, who care about the struggle, for the 99%, for the struggle of the 99% for political and economic justice, the re-election of Obama is absolutely nothing to celebrate. We have had close to 4 years of one of the most obscene transfers of wealth from working people to the 1% that's ever been witnessed in history. We have seen police violence, brutality, incarceration, mass deportations, and restrictions on civil liberties that have significantly worsened since Bush left office in 2008. So that, I think, we can't be sympathetic to, this idea that, we can understand why people do it, but we politically we can't say, that's something to celebrate, the re-election. On the second point, I think this is where we should be celebrating, with people, in terms of how, that the loony right in this country didn't get their election year pot shot. And gain even further momentum in mainstream political discourse. Right now, the right is regaining a lot of momentum that's lost with the Obama election and throughout some of the different twists and turns, and this may have given them some more momentum. But, this is not an insignificant thing. It does have an effect, on how people view political possibilities. If people see the right wing as dominant and powerful, in the mainstream political landscape, it can constrain how people think about what's possible to fight for. And I think anybody that lived through the Bush years or heard about living through the Bush years can see what that feels like, to be under 8 years where the right wing is dominant politically. That being said, the actual legislation, the celebrating the existence of the idea that this actual legislation would in any significant way improve the healthcare system in this country for working class and poor people, that we actually need to be very crystal clear with people on. And we're gonna argue here in this talk that the Affordable Care Act was in the most fundamental ways a massive step backwards for healthcare in this country. And in fact, far from standing in the legacy of the Social Security Act and Medicare, the ACA is a partial negation of those historic working class victories. So, you know, put simply, the Affordable Care Act can and will make a broken system actually decidedly worse for ordinary people. If you look at what this means, you know, over the next decade, you know, we're gonna argue that the Supreme Court actually upheld a decidedly reactionary piece of legislation. And, you know, not only did they uphold the law that was horrible to begin with, they actually worsened it, right? One of the key progressive elements of the law, which was the expansion of Medicaid, now is undermined by the fact that states can opt out of the requirement to expand Medicaid in those states. And if that actually wasn't bad enough, that opting out of allowing some of the, basically the poorest states, you know, well, then have some of the poorest people and the people that need the health insurance the most will actually have less access to, you know, the only safety net that really exists in this country for the healthcare is Medicaid. You actually then from a legal standpoint, from the Supreme Court, it opens up that ruling about states' rights, essentially, actually opens up a significant opening for states to opt out of lots of federally funded programs, because before they were compelled to, because they would lose federal funding. It opens up a possibility for massive legal challenges by states to actually withdraw from a number of federally funded. And if you look at how the right works in this country, and you look at how they advance, you look at how women's rights, immigration, you know, what do? They go in the reactionary states, the more right-wing states, they test out, you know, whether it's Arizona or Georgia, you know, and pass legislation and try and use that as test cases, right? And this strengthens their ability to do that, this ruling, vis-a-vis the decision. So there's obviously much more to say about the ruling. We're going to touch on it definitely some more throughout the talk. But I think what a main thing we need to do to get our heads around the actual legislation is to kind of take a step back and look at, okay, what does the healthcare system actually look like for people, for real people, for patients, for nurses, for healthcare providers, for doctors? We need also then to come to some kind of basic understanding of some of the fundamental flaws in the healthcare system, why it looks so horrible, why it doesn't provide the care that it needs. The U.S. spends more money than any other country in the history of the world per patient on healthcare, and delivers, you know, what by one measure, U.S. is 37th in the world in terms of healthcare outcomes. Spends more money, gets far worse care than any other industrialized country. So we need to understand why that is. Hannah is then going to spend a big chunk of time, you know, talking about the actual Health Care Act and really breaking it down and talking about what are some of the fundamental problems. And then I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about, I think we need to kind of formulate for this moment, for the next, you know, few months and year, beginning to formulate a perspective for healthcare activists and to kind of get our bearings in this present moment. So I guess first a quick straw poll is, who in this room, you know, doesn't have any health insurance in one form or another, Medicaid, Medicare, anything? So that's a good chunk. It's probably a representative percentage of the population. For those who do have health care insurance, how many feel that you love it? that it doesn't drain your bank account with co-pays and deductibles and premiums, that it doesn't drain your soul, you know, with mind-numbing hours spent on the phone or standing in line trying to talk to an insurance company or a doctor's office or a hospital billing office trying to, you know, is there anybody out there that feels okay? Please leave. Yeah, there's five of you. Yeah. This talk.
I have a union job.
No excuse. No excuse. I have a union job too.
It really shows the fragmentation of the quality of healthcare. Some people get better deals, some people,
So, you know. So for the question for the whole room, I mean, does anybody feel like in the last 2 years, especially for those five people, that's gotten any better in the last 2 years? That your access to anything, that anything related to you and the healthcare system has substantially challenged. So you know, that says something. Never. Yeah.
No, there is one thing, because they put in some things like coverage of pre-existing conditions.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that personally affected
older children.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, totally. No, I think that's mm-hmm. that's important. So, you know, okay, but that gives a sense of, you know, how people, you know, I think how, what the lay of the land is, you know, that's, I think that's useful. I think, you know, but I guess some of the scenario I want to lay out, I think for most of the people in this country, for you know, most of the 99%, when you get sick, you know, the best case scenario, you know, for healthcare coverage involves intense anxiety and stress about your ability to pay for it. Okay, I'm really behind. So, anyway, yeah, that you know, basically, because people have health insurance, it's based on employer-based coverage. Your anxiety about healthcare is not only related to the deductibles and premiums and the financial burden that just having healthcare means. It's tied to the job, the anxiety about whether your job that you have is going to continue to exist, right? And even if you feel secure in the moment, you certainly, most of us don't feel secure in any significant way about our ability to be employed over the next 5, 10, 15 years. I think, you know, myself, I'm a nurse at a city hospital. You know, I, you know, don't pay a premium on my health care. I have a deductible of $100 per family member for prescription drugs. But my hospital system's facing massive cuts. You know, so, you know, $700 million next year for New York City Public Hospital System. And so, you know, what kind of security, you know, does that provide in terms of when you think about what my healthcare is going to look like? You know, if you're poor and enough to qualify for Medicaid, if you're old enough to qualify for Medicare, I think, you know, you're facing a situation where you're lining up in massive lines for appointments. You're getting massively underfunded care, essentially, and that's getting substantially worse because the state by state over the, since the financial crisis hit, they're looking for ways to slash federally funded. Even though they get matching funds from the federal government, the states are looking for ways to slash funding for those programs. So you get coverage, but it's a kind of the quality of the care that you have access to. So that's a definite question. And then if you're uninsured, it's Russian roulette, right? If you get sick, you're either gonna go massively into debt, or you're going to go bankrupt, or you're gonna have, you know, situations like there was a guy in Tennessee I heard 2 weeks ago who set himself on fire in his front lawn because of financial stress. You know, I mean, there's the bankruptcy and the situation, the financial precariousness of the vast majority of the working class in this country is a profound physical and psychological phenomenon that the healthcare system is absolutely exacerbating. 60% of bankruptcies are healthcare related. 75% of those 60% are because people didn't have any insurance. Yeah. So it's a real question. So I guess that paints a little bit of a picture. I guess I'll just briefly go through, you know, oh, no, I wanted to make sure to mention something real quick, too. If you're among even the most vulnerable sections of society, namely undocumented immigrants, your health care, not only do you not have, mainly sometimes not have insurance, but you can't even do things like get organ transplants and get on the door. And the struggle of the little village in Chicago was really inspiring in the sense that there are a group of people who actually fought to get some coverage for people that don't have access among some of the most, you know, oppressed and vulnerable sections of society. So that's a bit of the general picture. I mean, why does it look this way? Why in the richest country in the history of the world that spends more money on healthcare than any country in the history of the world does it look this way? So it all boils down to the existence of private health insurance. Fundamentally, the existence of a system based on employer-based private health insurance is the fundamental reason why our healthcare system is screwed up. There are a number of things that flow from that. There's a number of other things that run parallel to it, but that is the fundamental crisis. Partially, what that results in is a massive siphoning off of resources in the form of profits. Healthcare industry makes between $12 and $14 billion in profits every year that gets sucked out of the system. not only the health insurance industry, but actually the pharmaceutical industry dwarfs the health insurance industry in terms of profits and waste. They make $40 to $50 billion in profits every year, and they waste another about $10 to $20 billion in advertising every year, which is why every fourth commercial you see on television is for a pharmaceutical drug. And then you have the profound waste of a system where we know how much time we waste dealing with the healthcare system. That is wasted through millions of dollars in clerical workers and nurses and doctors that are employed by all these different interested parties, that whether it's a health insurance company, a hospital, there are armies of these people working in all these different facilities fighting with each other on how people get paid. And that creates up to 25% to 30% of every healthcare dollar within the private insurance industry going just to administration and not to patient care. So those are the basics. I think, you know, about why our healthcare system is in the mess that it's in. So I think that then lays the context for what then the Affordable Health Care Act attempts to address and attempts to resolve or tries to mitigate in some way. And this is, I think, hopefully we'll get a clearer picture of what that has actually looked like over the last couple of years.
Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Excellent. Okay, so I'm going to try not to be redundant. One thing just to make, because the whole bill has been so confusing, and I think one of the things that we thought would be struck down, that all of the press seemed to think would be struck down, was the individual mandate, which is the mandate that more than 30 million people in this country purchase really bad private health insurance, and then be penalized if they don't buy it, and purchasing it with lots of out-of-pocket expenses, deductibles, et cetera. So this was actually upheld by the Supreme Court, as you saw yesterday, by a narrow margin. The part of it that was struck down that was a big surprise to me and many others was the mandate that states expand Medicaid coverage to include not just those below poverty, but those up to 133% of the poverty level, which, as we all know, is still an abysmally, horrible level. 130, the poverty level in this country is so horribly low. So there, the way the legislation was written was that states would be penalized by having federal funding withdrawn if they did not expand Medicaid coverage to people living 133% above the poverty level. And this was actually what was struck down by the Supreme Court. So now the states have the option to simply say, no, we don't think that we can or want to expand Medicaid coverage to more people, and so we just won't, and there will be no penalties. So this is something that, where people are just trying to get their heads around what this will mean and how it will play out along partisan lines. But that this is an important thing to understand, that it's only in this kind of twisted, upside-down landscape that you see the right wing, whose interests you'd think would be in this victory for corporate healthcare, arguing against the mandate for people to buy health insurance, and then having this other thing. Anyway, it's just all very bizarre. So let me read what I've got here. So, is yesterday's ruling a victory for the left because the right see it as a defeat? How can we see something as a victory for the left that enshrines the blood-sucking private health insurance industry in power and delivers them literally over $1 trillion in the next decade? I'll say this again because it's so horrible and disgusting. While it is a mistake for us to support the Affordable Care Act only on the grounds that it is a defeat for the right, It may actually open up opportunities for true single payer in states like Vermont, and I think Sean's going to talk that, about that a little. So we don't want to see this as completely a defeat. When I was talking about this at home, I was talking about the Affordable Care Act, and my son misheard me and thought I said the Horrible Care Act, so that's what I like to call it now. He's like, what are you talking about, the Horrible Care Act? And I said, yes, that's what it is, the Horrible Care Act. So what is this Horrible Care Act that has caused so much hoopla? It's been declared unconstitutional by the right wing. It's earned Obama being called a fascist, a socialist, a bringer of death panels. Remember that whole thing? What the Affordable Care Act is like a lot of legislation we see, is basically a hodgepodge of some modest but decent reforms, like coverage for people up to age 26 on their family health plan, not being excluded because of pre-existing conditions, expansion of Medicaid, some reining in of private health insurance. So there's some modest and decent reforms, but these have mainly been a small concession on the part of the private health insurance industry in order to gain themselves a shift of literally billions of dollars in profit their way. They have been delivered 30 million paying customers because of this legislation that has been passed. The provision that was especially attacked by the right wing, as we know, is the individual mandate. It's been attacked by the right because it was seen as an infringement on the individual liberty to choose to not have health care. A terrible infringement on our liberties. And of course, we on the left oppose it, but for very different reasons. We oppose it because we see it as a mandate to hand over one's money to a vastly profitable industry that profits not from providing people with care, but from denying them care. And that's what the health insurance industry basically is. Okay, sorry, let's see. The right wing has Obama cannot, okay, so this is what Obama has said, and I wanted to play a video clip, but I wasn't able to find it exactly, but Obama, in defending himself from the attacks of socialism, there's a great clip where he says, you know, I would really like, through my plan, for everyone to have health insurance, but I can't force them to. There will always be some people who just think, I'm so healthy, why do I need health insurance? Or other people need it, but I don't. And, you know, there's nothing I can do about that, but I'll do everything I can to try to help people get it, but I can't force them to. So he kind of plays into this idea that, he's doing everything he can to help people get it, but they just don't know what's good for them. And if they don't want to have this wonderful health insurance, then, well, that's on them, and he's done what he could. I think Sean talked about this a little, but one really, really important thing to remember is that this plan, the framework for it, and not the, I'm not talking about the small reforms that we would actually, as socialists, fight for, because they actually expand coverage in a meaningful way to some millions of people. I'm talking about the individual mandate framework. It was originally written by the private insurance industry and signed off on by a former vice president of the private insurance industry. Those are the terms of the plan, and just help us to understand why it is the way it is. We on the left are opposed to this, not because it's socialism, not because it's fascism, not because it's unconstitutional. All of these, I think, are red herrings thrown out by the right wing, but because it literally hands over $1 trillion in additional profits for the private insurance industry over the next decade. And still, now if it did that and everyone would have amazing, wonderful care, maybe we could say, all right, so that is a reform that we can live with under capitalism. It will still leave millions of people some of them because they are here illegally, and others because they will not be able to benefit from the Medicaid expansion, which has now been whatever, the states have been let off the hook. They don't actually have to expand Medicaid. So millions of people will still have wholly inadequate insurance and still be vulnerable to bankruptcy and out-of-pocket expenses that will force them to choose between food, utilities, et cetera, and needed health care for themselves and their children. And this, I keep repeating this over 1 trillion figure because it's just so huge and shocking. And if you look at the amount that was spent by private health insurance industry and big pharma lobbying Congress and politicians leading up to the passage of the health care reform, it was, let's see, I always mix up the numbers. Was it a million or a billion? Anyway, it was a huge amount of money, and most of it went to the Democrats, which is not surprising. So just to make it clear, I am not making an ultra-left argument that we should just let the healthcare system spin out of control, which it will if it continues on the course that it's on. We are arguing for meaningful and feasible reform that will actually alleviate suffering and save tens of thousands of lives. Tens of thousands of people in this country die every year because they are underinsured or uninsured. I don't know how many people saw Michael Moore's film Sicko, but I thought the brilliant thing about it was that it didn't focus on the uninsured, it focused on people who had insurance and who were still suffering horribly. There was the woman who had asthma, and she went to Cuba and saw that this asthma pump that she had to spend hundreds of dollars a month on and not be able to pay her utilities bill could actually be bought in Cuba for something like 10 cents. There were, just to see how the for-profit health industry is sucking the life and blood out of people. The much heralded end to the denial of coverage based on pre-existing conditions, coverage up to age 26 on family policies, expansion of Medicaid, closing the donut hole in Medicare, these were essentially minor concessions made by the private insurance industry to ensure mind-blowing profits. I don't mean to minimize the impact and the benefit of these things for individuals, and for me myself in the beginning when they were talking about Medicare for people starting at age 55, I was like ready to go out and dance in the streets because it would mean that I could stop working in 6 years. The main reason I have to stay at my job is to keep my have health insurance for my family. So these things, I don't mean to minimize them at all. They're huge things, but like Physicians for a National Health Program says, we do not condone the prescription of aspirin for cancer. We are looking at, and again, it's like the arguments we hear that there's not enough food for everyone. There is enough food for everyone in this world. There's enough medical care for everyone in this world. The culprit is the profit-making system, big pharma, private health insurance, the idea that it has to be for profit. There's no scarcity of resources, as we're told. It's a huge mistake, I think, to defend Obamacare or any other liberal reform for that matter, simply because it is under attack from the right. We need to take a strong stand and explain clearly how our position comes from an entirely different basis and motivation from that of the right. We are not concerned with the right wing's red herring of constitutionality, but rather with fighting for healthcare as a human right and against its commodification. As you have heard and will hear in other talks, neoliberalism's answer to economic crisis is almost always privatization. And we see this happening across the board. Education is privatized, healthcare is privatized. In New York State, Medicaid is being privatized. All the patients I see have been forced to enroll in Medicaid managed care plans, which limit their care, limit the medications they can be on. Virtually every patient I see as a therapist in the last year has been forced to stop taking a certain needed medication, whether it's for HIV, asthma, diabetes, psychiatric issues, and go on to a generic, which may or may not serve the same purpose for them. And the amount of suffering and anxiety this causes is beyond belief. I want to go quickly through a few of the myths. How much time do I have? There are a lot of myths.
7 minutes.
7 minutes. Okay, I'm going to go quickly through some of the myths and false premises that have dictated the terms of this debate. And again, so much of what we talk about here is true in other cases. The terms of the debate, because of the our two-party system, the terms of the debate tend to be dictated by the right. And in this case, what we see is that the argument for single-payer universal health care has been virtually absent from the debate about health care reform, which has turned into really a debate about health insurance reform and what the health insurance companies can get. Okay, so number one myth. Only with the passage of the individual mandate will health insurance companies be able to afford to provide coverage for those who have pre-existing conditions. National health care will cost much more. It is only cheaper now because so many are not insured. So basically the argument here is if you insure everyone, then the people who have insurance now will get even less because there's only so much to go around. This assumes that health insurance companies need to continue to exist and to make vast profits. It completely ignores the models from every other industrialized country in the world which has national health care. All of them are much less expensive and have better health outcomes. Everyone. Single payer would save in this country an estimated $40 billion a year, mainly on unnecessary paperwork, bureaucracy, overhead. But this is not even the issue. And again, even that argument is dictated by the right. Even if it were more expensive to provide health care for everyone in this country, which it wouldn't be, we would still fight for it because it is a human right. And because there is enough money in the world for everyone to have decent health care, for everyone to have enough to eat, for everyone to have housing. The argument, this kind of Malthusian argument that there's only so much to go around and that it's overpopulation, that it's because people are having too many babies and people are using too much health care, is a load of crap, and it will always distract you from the reality of the situation. Another myth, people will make better choices and thus reduce health care costs if they are better informed. Now, of course, it's nice to have information and be better informed, and being an informed consumer can be a good thing, but that does not address the root cause. All of the information in the world will not help you when you are forced to choose from an array of crappy insurance plans, and that's all there is to that. There's another myth. Most people in the United States are against Obamacare, and all of them are right-wingers. Most of them are members of the Tea Party. We know this is not true. What you do not hear at all in the mainstream media is that a lot of opposition to Obamacare comes from the left, that most physicians are opposed to Obamacare because they favor single-payer health care. And that, again, the polls are very confusing and the way that they're posed to people is very confusing. But if you look, if you do sort of a meta-analysis, it's fairly clear that most people in the country favor coverage for everyone. Let's see, I already talked about the idea of resource constraints and this Malthusian idea. Okay, so another one. Without competition, and this you hear in every, these are arguments that we hear all the time, ruling class ideology. Without competition in the free market, no one would bother to develop all the incredible medications and technology that make our system the best. This rests on the false premise that innovation and creativity are only driven by the profit motive. This is based in a view of human nature which mistakes our current horribly deformed state, deformed by capitalism, for the essence of human nature, that we are driven by competition, by greed, etc. And this is another whole talk, but something that I think is wholly false and refutable. There's the whole racial disparities thing. If we reduce racial disparities in access to healthcare, then all will be well. Most of the efforts I've seen to reduce racial disparities in access to care fail to address the root cause, which is poverty, and the for-profit health system. They focus on things like patient education, improved patient-provider communication. One program in my hospital involved taking poor African American patients to the Whole Foods market so they could learn how to make healthy food choices. I can't even tell you, I mean, these are whatever, just 2 minutes left. Okay, you get the idea. Another thing we hear often is that universal healthcare in the United States is just not realistic. It would cost too much, people won't stand for socialism, or the corporations just won't yield. Now, you know, of course there's some truth to these things, but I think what is really unrealistic is believing that we can have universal and affordable healthcare in a system dominated by big pharma and private insurance. That is what the Affordable Care Act is attempting to do, and it's really a pathetic, I mean, I can't even say it's an attempt. The reality is that if premiums, health insurance premiums, continue to rise at the same rate as they have, and our incomes do not rise, in 13 years, premiums will take up our entire salaries, if you look at the chart. And so, I mean, that's it. There will be, it's just, it's like eating, it's the thing eating itself alive. And so the idea that if we don't pass this bill now, nothing will ever change, that it can't keep going the way it is, and people are beginning to realize that if they haven't already, and people will be out in the streets fighting, and most healthcare providers will be out in the streets fighting to make things change. Let's see, the other thing that I have found in my healthcare place is a blaming of, and again, people who work in healthcare will be familiar with this. We've heard about the 99%, the 1%. Now we hear about the 10% overutilizers. This is the problem with the healthcare system. These 10% of people who account for over 50% of costs because they overutilize healthcare. And you can just imagine these greedy, lazy people. They don't go to Whole Foods. They don't go to the gym. They don't take care of themselves. And they have to use, they just love getting health care all the time. They go and they go, and it's so expensive, and they love it, and they'd rather go there than to Whole Foods. So this is now the culprit, these 10%, and we are made to believe that they are greedy and lazy, and that that's the problem, and that's what's driving health care costs. And of course, if you look at it, I mean, these are mainly people who do not have access to preventive health care. They go to the emergency room because they don't have regular primary care. They get hospitalized because they're very sick. They mainly suffer from many of the chronic conditions, including HIV, asthma, diabetes, etc., that people in poverty-stricken areas suffer from because those are the conditions that they live in. And so this is now, you know, again, blame the victim. We hear about it all the time. This is a classic example of blame the victim. And Rahm Emanuel's brother, Zeke Emanuel, is a wonderful proponent of this, of blaming the 10% overutilizers for everything that's wrong with the healthcare system. So what can we expect to see now that the individual mandate has been upheld? We can look at Massachusetts, what's happened there. Rapidly rising underinsurance, high deductible plans have more than tripled.
Yeah.
No decrease in medical bankruptcy. Shared sacrifice, tighten your belts, as always means that the burden falls on the working class. 63% of residents now report the law is hurting rather than helping them. In New York City, where I work, the hospitals have now decided to start charging Medicaid patients a $3 copay for every visit. Now, I work in an HIV clinic. People often have to come in several times a week. They live below poverty. $3 a visit. The people I work with say, oh, $3, that's nothing. They should be $3 a visit, you multiply it by 10 times a month, people stop getting care. That's what co-pays mean. It means people don't get the care they need, they get sicker. Whatever the copay is, whether it's $3 or $30, and we all know that, you avoid going. So remember, at least even with the passage of the Affordable Care Act, which will help some people, absolutely, and we will always fight for any reform that will help in a meaningful way, that will better the lives and decrease suffering of people in the here and now, whether it's revolutionary or not. The Affordable Care Act will still leave at least 27 million people uninsured. It will increase the number of people who are underinsured, who have insurance, but it's shitty. We need to stop thinking of the percent of people insured as the outcome, as the, like, the gold standard. That is not the gold standard. That is not what we want to go for. We want to fight against the commodification of healthcare. We want to fight for healthcare as a privilege, not as a privilege, but as a human right. We want to challenge the idea that private insurance and pharmaceutical industries need to continue to make profit in order for us to have good health. And that's all. I'm going to stop there because I'm already over. Sean's going to talk a little about the fight that lies ahead. And obviously, there's a lot of fighting still to be done so that we can all get home.
Just a couple quick things, just flood from Hannah's talk. People made it, you know, the health insurance industry made record profits in the last 3 years. During a recession, during a global financial meltdown. They made more profits partially because people were actually using it less, right? So people, because of copays, because of premiums, because of deductibles, weren't actually using their insurance as much because they were broke and can't afford those things. The deductibles, people have a $4,000 deductible and you get sick. People are like, okay, I'm not gonna actually spend that money because I don't have it. And so, partially, that's why actually insurance companies in this recession made actually significant profits. Think of what a sick system that actually turns out to be. I hate copays. They're like financial mosquitoes. They're just like, ugh. Copays. They just drag on your brain. And also just one other thing, follow up from Hannah's talk. People really need to look into Massachusetts and look at what is coming down the pike in terms of the ACA. Mm-hmm. People, it is an incredibly unpopular plan. People are more in financial jeopardy. People are paying more for their health care, not less, in terms of, even though they're covered, but people are paying more into the system. So, and they're way less, substantial chunks of people are way less satisfied. I don't have the statistics handy, but.
63%.
Yeah, she has the statistics handy, I'm sorry. So anyway, be brief, we need to get to the discussion. I think the ruling, Supreme Court ruling, kind of closed a window that would have existed if it would have been struck down for renewing a national debate around healthcare and for a single payer to actually be once again debated. The right obviously would have had an advantage in some ways, but the left could have inserted itself and it could have renewed some ability for the forces that exist. National Nurses United, PNHP, Healthcare Now, these groups are small, but National Nurses United isn't that small. But they could have actually taken that and actually, ran with it. It did close a window, so I think that has to kind of be acknowledged as part of our understanding of this. I think, one sort of, shining star could be, Vermont, the struggle for a single payer system in Vermont. There's some major obstacles ever since it was passed. The corporations have absolutely regrouped and gone on a massive counteroffensive in Vermont and are looking for every single possibility to undermine it, but there's still a very critical fight that's happening. The Vermont single payer plan will take I think total of close to 6 years, 6 to 8 years to implement. And so in that time, it's like, you know, sort of a pitched battle. So that's something that, that we should be looking to and figure out, because it will have, that battle will have something to say about what the longer term perspectives for single payer. There's some real kind of interesting things going on in terms of the, that right now. The Service Employees International Union has actually sort of kind of all of a sudden joined the fight for single payer in Vermont. They've come in with organizers and lots of money and kind of created some parallel coalitions fighting for single payer. This is a union that has never actually supported single payer. They're a union that has been very closely tied with the Democratic Party. And this is a union that you have to be very suspicious of their motivations in terms of just, they don't represent any workers in Vermont. So it's like, why all of a sudden do they jump in with money and organizers to, I mean, problem is, people are desperate for money and organizers. You know what I mean? So it's kind of like, you know, it presents some political questions in terms of what's the fight needs there. But you know, the word Trojan horse has come up in the context of that conversation in terms of what that means in terms of the political nature and who has control over the political direction of that fight. So I think that's something to think about. And just in general, it raises a broader point about the role of the Democratic Party in social movements, right? Especially social movements that challenge the interests of corporations in this country. And obviously one of the biggest profitable corporations is the healthcare industry. So, you know, the role of organizations like SEIU, other Democratic Party connected organizations have to be really, you know, considered. I think, you know, so that's the fight for access, and there's other fights around access. We need to look at where the states are cutting Medicaid and Medicare, and we need to look for fights around that. We need to look at where hospitals are being closed, and look for fights around that. Those are all part of like really trying to preserve access on the ground to healthcare, because those are some of the fallout from some of the healthcare legislation that's not addressing the needs of cities and states and things like that to actually sustain the healthcare system as it exists in this recession. So those are fights around access. I would also argue though that we need to look to additional fights that grapple with the question of healthcare. And you know, there's a massive influx of, there's a new, not a new phenomenon, but an expanded phenomenon of bedside debt collectors in hospitals, right? People who come to your hospital bed when you're sick, basically shaking you down for what, you know, what's your insurance, how much can you afford to pay, you know, when you get admitted to a hospital. Like, there's things like this that are part of the pressure cooker that this healthcare system is forcing on people that we have to look for real opportunities to fight around and wage campaigns around, because it is pretty stark. A particular struggle near and dear to my heart is the fight for better nursing care. I think, and that's a fight that really has resources behind it. I mean, I think the most significant reform, not the HCA, the most significant reform that's happened for healthcare in this country in the last probably 15, 20 years has been their staff ratios in California. Where you have in California, you're guaranteed one nurse for every five patients on a medical floor. And that, in terms of improving the quality of healthcare, and when you go to the hospital, like, that's a significant thing. There's, we took over our union in New York, reform room, we took over our, we're now national, a statewide initiative to get staffing ratios passed in New York. So it's like, there's those kinds of opportunities that we as healthcare activists should look for. Not that we should forget about single payer, not that we should forget about Vermont, not that any of those things are true, and that we should bring these messages into whatever healthcare fights. I'm just saying that there's a number of other fronts that we can fight on in the here and now, as this sort of window has kind of closed in this moment around the national question of single payer. So that's what I'll lay out, and I look forward to the discussion.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.